Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi.
And I'm Chef James Regatto.
And on this episode of Essential Cooking, we talk with Chef Jared Gadbaugh about being a chef in New York City, working at a 2-star Michelin restaurant, and coming back to Detroit to open Oak and Reel.
All right, so we have Jared Gadbaugh, Oak and Reel. Thank you for coming in. Oak and Reel is a wonderful restaurant. I was just there a few days ago, and you opened up at the least convenient time to open a restaurant, and that was what month, actually, in 2020?
That was September of 2020.
Yeah.
So kind of right smack between the two closures.
Barely allowed to serve people by law at the time, and you opened up your restaurant. So was that your most challenging year in your entire storied career?
It was, with any restaurant opening, there's always challenges. So it doesn't, it all just feels like one big challenge versus, kind of navigating. I think 2021 was probably the biggest challenge in realizing, you got to keep the lights on, you got to figure out a way to kind of carve your path through this, storm that we had all, experienced. And, when we opened back up in February was when, you had to figure out what 25% looks like. And thankfully, we had a big restaurant and we were able to kind of carve a path through it. And, I didn't have a lot of staff, so I didn't have to do the layoffs. And it didn't, it wasn't heartbreaking in that way. I could just kind of grow naturally and carve a path forward.
Because you come out of New York City. When did you go to New York City? Because you're originally from Michigan. When did you move to New York City?
I graduated from Michigan State in 2001 and moved to New York in December of 2002. I went there to go to culinary school. I went to the French Culinary Institute, and I thought I'd be there a couple of years. I'd move back and I'd, open a restaurant and have great success. And, I quickly realized that it takes a lot longer to learn how to cook and or to do anything well. And then... I started, having all these opportunities. I met a guy named Michael White, and it kind of changed my life. We opened a restaurant together that kind of changed my trajectory forever.
Because that's Maria. You think you guys earned 2 Michelin stars while you were there, correct?
Correct.
And Maria's a beautiful restaurant, sits right on Central Park there. And how long were you actually at Maria?
I was the opening chef in 2009 we opened. And was there until we moved home in 2018.
That's a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So, in the first year we earned 1 Michelin star in November of that first year. And then the second year we earned our 2nd Michelin star, and we kept them the entire time I was there.
Can you talk about how things change once you get that star?
I mean, for me, it wasn't... The expectation, even here where I don't have any Michelin stars, is always the same. You want perfection. You want to make the best food you can make every plate, every time, no matter the day or the period. So, before Maria, I worked at a place called 11 Madison Park for a chef named Daniel Hum. And he had just moved here from California, and it was kind of, Michelin stars at the time were kind of new, they just came to North America in 2005. So in New York, we had Zagat, and that was kind of like the rating system for the city. And, Michelin kind of started taking over, and you started to, create a buzz. So working for Daniel, you kind of learned, what the standard was and how to elevate your standard so that, everything you do is just that much more elevated. And even when you slip, you're still, higher than most. Mm-hmm. So, I think kind of just training and conditioning, yourself to expect that of yourself and your team was something I learned, kind of before Michelin. And I surrounded myself with other people that felt the same way. And, it's a team sport. Working in a kitchen it's not just me. And it's just, everybody there was kind of working towards that same goal and holding themselves to those same standards. And it kind of steamrolls, you get more students that want to be a part of it. You get, and everybody is bought into this system, and it's really hard, to be a slacker when everybody else is, pushing to keep this on their resume, because it's good for everybody. It's good for the restaurant. It's good for the people that work there. It allows people to kind of, set their bar higher and take those leaps from, being a cook to being a sous chef to being a chef de cuisine to being a chef owner, so.
How long were you at 11 Madison Park?
A year and a half.
Was that when they had Stars already?
No, Dan, that was the first year that Daniel came from Campton Place.
Because that was when EMP was like that, like tavern, right? It was,
yep.
Yeah, that was a Danny Meyer restaurant. That was kind of like a, it was a casual-ish concept.
Very much so.
And that's a great story. There's a lot of coverage on this, but being a part of that transition was probably pretty formative.
Yeah, I honestly, I didn't know anything about Daniel. I think I responded to a Craigslist ad, and I walked in, and I was like blown away by what the food was and the attention to detail. And Daniel was there every day expoing, and it was like this beautifully, you know, difficult place to work. I mean, I think when I was there, I was there a year and a half, and I think we went through well over 100 line cooks.
Oh my God.
100?
13 different sous chefs.
I mean, this is
five
also,
pastry chefs.
How many people, I mean, how many cooks in that kitchen at any given moment?
It was tough to keep them around, but no more than I have at Oak and Reel now. Mm. You know, it was probably, seven, you know, hourly line cooks on the line. Four or five sous chefs, you know, three or four pastry, yeah, so a bunch of, you know,
100 is a lot of, that's
a lot.
Lot
I mean,
turnover.
Every day it was, you know, you had a game plan where you were being really nice to the stages, cause you wanted them to work so you could get
stay.
A day off. And yeah, it was one of those places that was, you know, but it's amazing to see all of the people that went through there, and, you know, they're all at the top of, you know, at the top of the chef's list of, yeah, you know, of all the cities that they're in. So,
and then was Marea a different culture then? What did you not have that problem?
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, if you speak with anybody, I hope that works for me. You know, I'm more of a lead by example. You know, do the dirty work so that, you know, people can see how it should be done, and bring people up versus, you know, you know, more of the old school. I mean, and culture in general has changed, kitchen culture. I mean, you know, definitely. There's the exposure, all of the, you know, the Me Toos, all these things have changed workplace culture, you know, in general. So, you know, it was kind of right at that pivotal point where, you know, you had to kind of clean up your act if you were one of those, you know, habitual offenders in some of these, you know, with some of these bad habits. But Marea was, you know, was definitely more of a communal, we're doing this together. You know, cooks could put forth dishes for, you know, menu, you know, to put on the menu. I mean, it was very collaborative and pretty awesome. And it was like, I mean, the amount of the volume that we did, you know, it was like we'd serve 500 to 600 guests a day, every single day, 365 days a year.
And that's courses too. That's,
yeah,
like,
that's courses,
know,
that's like tasting
eight
menus.
Plates,
yeah,
of guests,
it's great.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, you know, we'd have, you know, chefs from the Ducasse group come and stage, and, you know, they'd be like, I don't believe that you guys, you know, had two Michelin stars do this kind of volume. And they come and they'd be like, holy smokes. Like,
yeah.
This is, you know, it was a beast of a restaurant that, like, that's, you know, made people grow quickly. You
that's
know?
So beneficial though. I feel like volume is something that so many higher end places and fine dining chefs struggle with. And it's like, once you get into actually owning your own place, you have to have a healthy relationship with volume, because art and, you know, the perfect, you know, perfection, right, which doesn't exist, but it's hard to even approach that with volume. But if you don't have volume, investors aren't happy, you don't stay in business.
We'll be right back right after this.
So, I mean, New York, you know, it's two Michelin star Manhattan restaurant couldn't be more, you know, different than coming back to Detroit. I mean, the Midwest is different. Detroit, Rust Belt. I mean, this is a very, if you weren't from here, I can't imagine you would have moved to Detroit just to try your hand at opening a restaurant in our food scene. But obviously when you're from here, you know, you probably came back, you have small children, you're going to raise your family, you're going to put down some roots. What do you think is the biggest difference in feeding the Midwest versus, you know, Manhattan? I mean, you're feeding a pretty international audience there. And we have some international audience, but most of your customers, I'm assuming, are locals that live in and around Detroit.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, the difference is that most people around here could care less about my Michelin stars or what I've done in the past. And so it's, you know, it's it's kind of retraining and re-going through the process of earning people's respect and trust. And, you know, and in the Midwest, you know, I serve mostly Italian seafood, you know, and we didn't grow up, you know, I grew up eating orange ruffy and, you know, and salmon. And, you know, so we didn't grow up eating octopus and oysters and caviar and sea urchin and all these things that, you know, are so integral to what I have done in the past. So, you know, for me, it was just kind of relearning how to approach, you know, a more wary, you know, a less traveled clientele, so that I can, you know, slowly integrate, you know, our goals into, you know, into a harmonious, you know, relationship between us and our clients. And that takes, you know, time, it takes earning trust, it takes, you know, press, it takes people saying that, you know, this is a place to eat. You know, it takes reviews, it takes all of these things, you know, to earn people's trust and to get people to come and check you out. You know, it's not enough anymore just to be a good chef, to have a good, you know, a good resume. You know, like you have to have, you know, good media, you have to have a good social, good, I mean, it's, there's so many more layers to it. So I think, you know, for me, the biggest difference is, you know, I'm a chef owner now. I've got, you know, the weight of financing and all that, all those, you know, burdens to bear, you know, as I figure out how to, you know, operate in this, with this different palette and these, you know, different sets of expectations.
The most important question, New York pizza or Detroit style pizza? The people want to know, because I'm sure you spent a lot of time in New York.
I'm more of a Neapolitan style.
Oh, okay. I'm
gonna thread the New York.
I love here. Honestly. Yeah. I love all pizza. Yeah. There's no wrong answer. What is your favorite slice in New York? What's the best slice?
I think Lucali probably has the best pizza in New York from when I was there.
Sure.
It's in Brooklyn.
Oh, I know. I'm very familiar with Lucali. I think I'm a Luigi's Park Slope guy.
All right.
I like what they do there. But what about all right, real quick, what's your favorite Detroit style pizza?
I mean, when I moved back, we went with the old classic. We go to Buddy's, every Friday, and you know, we live in Farmington Hills, so you know, we take the kids every year to get there at 5 o'clock, right on the dot.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you wait, you know, for the second seating.
Is that Northwestern Highway?
Yeah. So you know, we'd go there, and every Friday night, and the family and kids still get it every day, or every Friday.
That's pretty great. One final question: can you talk about the Upright?
The Upright is a cocktail bar, a speakeasy-like cocktail bar located in the lower level at Oak and Reel. You know, when I moved here, I never said, hey, you know what, I really want a bar beyond the bar that serves the restaurant. But you know, the space that Oak and Reel, you know, is in, ended up being a much larger footprint than we really were looking for. And, you know, in my head, I was like, all right, you know, what could we turn this essentially large storage space that I had into, you know, down the road, you know, where it could put some money into it. It could be, you know, something that would generate without causing too much trouble. And you know, we had a great team. And so we kind of pushed forward, and we opened a very beautiful little kind of gem of a cocktail bar for the neighborhood. And, you know, it's a space that can function as a lot of different spaces. You know, it can be a private event space for people to have birthday parties. You know, it can be somewhere for some of our other events to have, you know, a cocktail hour reception and then come over and have dinner. And then it functions as a traditional cocktail bar Friday and Saturday night from 6 o'clock until midnight.
That's pretty cool to have that extra space there.
Well, I have one last question. What food do you miss the most in New York City that obviously, you know, you can't get here? What do you crave? What do you find yourself middle of the night, cold sweat, thinking about?
I mean, the food that I crave most is generally Asian food, you know, so Vietnamese, Chinese, Japanese, Korean. I think that I have located enough of those places to kind of scratch those itches, you know, for the most part. But like a good Korean barbecue, you know, like an OG Korean barbecue where they're dragging around buckets of hot coals behind you, you know, seemed, you know, cause they're grandfathered in at these, you know, with these rates and an otherwise, you know, overly, restrictive, and I'm sure OSHA doesn't like having, and the fire department doesn't like having, you know, people running around a packed dining room with a bucket full of hot coals.
Oh, I love it though.
So I think, you know, I generally crave, you know, good Chinese food, good dim sum, you know, good Korean barbecue, Vietnamese, but there's a lot of great options here in Michigan.
No,
as
it's
well.
True. I think, you know, I crave like the Peking duck houses, like, I mean, obviously, you know, Hung Hua, there's a few places that do Peking duck, but I mean, there's nothing like the true hot, it's like the whole restaurant's just dedicated to it. So when I go to New York, I'm like rushing to get Peking duck.
Yeah.
But well, thank you so much for coming in. Obviously, you know, Oak and Reel is on Grand Boulevard on the north end, like you said, Milwaukee Junction. And you got kind of, I'm not gonna say funky, but I get confused sometimes because you're closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays, right?
Yep.
So you're Thursday through Monday.
Yep.
Which is great because Monday can be a tough time to find.
Sunday and Monday.
Yeah,
those are
tough days. So I'm sure that's intentional.
Yep.
And, but definitely don't, I've tugged on your door on Wednesdays quite a few times. So it's burned in my brain now. But, and then Upright is inside of your building in the basement, but that's only open what days?
Fridays and Saturdays.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much,
Jared,
for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to Essential Cooking. If you've been enjoying our show, please drop us a review and share it with a friend. This podcast is produced by me, Ann Delisi, with my co-host, James Rigotto. This episode was also produced, engineered, and edited by Connor Anderson, with production support from David Lyons, original music by the Mallet Brothers. Essential Cooking is a production of WDET, Detroit's NPR station.